Radio.
The Vocation of Healing. An interview with Dr. Andrew Fulme. So welcome, Dr. Andrew. Thanks for joining me.
You're welcome, Luke. It's a pleasure.
Now, the first question I want to ask you was, now, you're a GP, of course. What exactly does your position involve?
Well, as a general practitioner, I'm registered to see patients for medical consultations, and I see the general range of medical conditions that are seen in the community, coughs and colds, stomach upsets. We see unusual conditions, sometimes cancer, sometimes rarer conditions, autoimmune diseases. We see patients for health checks and health maintenance. And I also see patients for psychological problems and psychiatric issues as well. And sometimes there's a little bit of travel medicine thrown in. So just a general broad range of general practice that most general practitioners will see.
Now, what really drove you to take up a role like this?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when I was at school, finishing my last few years at school, of course, naturally enough, you think about, well, where I should be, what I should be doing, what things I should study. And at that stage, I'd had a bit of a conversion and saw things a little bit more of a religious light. And I did actually feel a sense of a vocation, a calling to enter the area of medicine. I felt a calling to heal, to be part of that ministry, if you like, maybe not so much fleshed out in those words, but certainly a calling to heal. And I also felt I wanted to be close to understand the meaning of suffering, to follow that journey. It's a bit of like a spiritual journey for myself. I must say it was a bit of a joke in my family when I let them know that this was what I was wanting to do, to enter the medicine, because I think, if I can remember it correctly, there used to be a bit of a joke in the family that I used to confuse what vomiting and diarrhea was. A bit of a laugh. Sort of thing. You've got to enter the medicine, you don't even understand what these words mean. So that was a bit of an interesting little anecdote in terms of my beginning, even before I began. But I suppose as I've sought to enter deeply into this mystery of suffering and growing and learning about my faith, I began to see it, of course, more in light of our Lord's own suffering, which we're coming up to right in the middle of Holy Week, and the great Paschal mystery, the suffering and death and resurrection. And then I began to see in my own life that as I entered medicine and then began it, how this mystery we have to enter into ourselves. A very difficult thing to do, of course, and I've been like suffering. But the good thing is we hang in there. There's always a resurrection. So, yeah, that's how I started out.
Okay. So you talked about your vocation to this healing ministry of sorts in this position. How does your faith influence your decisions and your activities and your day-to-day life as a general practitioner?
Well, I suppose the first thing is you have to strive. I have to strive to be the best doctor that I can be. Bearing in mind there's a lot of demands of time. It's not easy in a busy general practice. You're combining, obviously, the medical care and the medical expertise given to patients. But there's demands of time. There's demands to have compassion, to show compassion to people. And then the demands of the number of patients. Sometimes it's just a big crush. You know, as I've studied something called the theology of the body, Pope John Paul II, and studied his life, one thing that I think people have commented on is that when he was with people, he gave the impression you were the only person in the world that really mattered at that moment. And I see that as a wonderful challenge, an ideal to live up to, which I am far, far away off, far away off. A long way to go. And as I intimated, the pressure of sometimes the work and the number of patients, I think the other day I saw about 45, 46 patients, it's really hard to keep that wonderful ideal in your head. nonetheless, it's something I had to strive for and hope to improve a lot as I continue my work as a doctor.
So now any job, of course, has its challenges with regards to living out your faith in that job, even just a 9-to-5 office job. But especially so with your position, as medicine is really one of the frontiers going into the 21st century for the church, such as the approach to the dignity of the human person, to the dignity of life, for start of life and end of life issues. Are there any challenges in that way in living out your faith as a GP?
Oh, there are huge challenges. As we begin to live more in a secularized, or what Pope Benedict used to call, I think, the Christianized society, the morals in the teachings of the church become increasingly more out of step, or in contrast, sharp contrast to the morals of our society. And as a Catholic, of course, my faith informs those decisions that I make with my patients. There are certain things I can do and I can't do. I can't cooperate in what I know is evil, what is morally wrong. For instance, contraception, I can't prescribe contraceptive pill. Abortion, I can't refer people for abortions. I can't prescribe the morning after pill or give abortion agents like the RU486. I can't give referrals for in vitro fertilization. And I must say, I wasn't always of this strong mind, and it was difficult in the beginning to take a strong stance and to have the courage to stand up for those things which go against the grain or against what people desire or want, which are not actually correct or right or moral. And I must say, there was a couple of doctors, who, especially from the Opus Dei group, who are very, very good in this area, and they tell you, you know, quite plainly, well, we can't cooperate in these things. And so I think very early in my career, much to my shame, I did prescribe the pill a few times, but it was after the witness of some good, really good doctors who showed me, look, you know, you don't have to go along with these things. You actually say no. It's something that's okay to do. It's sometimes not particularly pleasant, but it sometimes has to be done. And it is a witness in many ways to be countercultural against the mores of our society. Having said that, there are things I can encourage. I can encourage things like natural family planning, now pro technology, and other health areas that are totally consistent with my faith and really emphasize those things, for sure. So, yeah, being a Catholic is certainly very challenging in today's society. Only the other day I had a girl who wanted a pregnancy test just to see how far she was along, and much to my great surprise, she then proceeded to say, oh, I want to have an abortion. I can't keep this baby. I've got one. I don't think I could cope. And I tried to tell her, well, you know, how are you going to cope with the guilt and all that? But she'd worked it out in her own mind, and she was quite adamant. So I'd like to really impress upon the listeners the absolute and irreplaceable need to pray for all those women out there. And there are millions of women out there who are contemplating abortion. I think in Australia, something like more than 100,000 women will choose to have an abortion every year in Australia. More than 100,000. The numbers are just staggering. And it's more than a million in the United States alone. Something like 50 million per year around the world, they say, are being aborted every year. It's a genocide. It's a great tragedy. So I'll take this opportunity to beg for prayers for those poor women who are considering abortion. You never really know what good you can do. A little child will be saved, and you know, you'll be credited for that by the good Lord. Thank you. Yeah, so I had to get that plug in.
Now, you mentioned before that there were some difficulties in the beginning. Do you mind taking us through a little bit with that? So from your university years, the start of your practice, and where did it come from? Did it come from pressure, or perhaps patients or lecturers at your university? Why exactly did those difficulties emerge?
Well, that's a good question. There are a number of difficulties. I don't think my health was particularly good at the end of my medical course, and I think I suffered from a little bit of chronic, a lot of chronic fatigue syndrome. And I found the course particularly stressful. It was a traditional six-year course, a lot of study, and our final year examinations were actually what we call live examinations. They're not written examinations, they're all presentations. And I wasn't particularly comfortable with live presentations, with voice-to-voice, with face-to-face examinations. I was particularly nervous. I didn't particularly like those sort of exams, and I didn't do well. I had to repeat my final year exams a few months after failing. And after that, my health wasn't all that good. So I suffered a lot from headaches and insomnia and so on. And so I had first-hand experience of suffering, constant headaches for decades. But, you know, good Lord, after, of course, I was praying for them to be better. I learned to accept them. And then, fun enough, not long after, maybe just a few years, it's hard to say, it's been a while now, I came across a number of natural health things that helped me get over these things, and now I've gone into some other areas, and most of those problems are really gone now. So it was a personal journey as well into suffering, and certainly challenge to practice when I didn't feel like practicing, suffering constantly from headaches and so on, but pushing on, and particularly residency is a particularly difficult stage of a doctor's career with long hours, night work and so on. Again, something I didn't particularly adapt very well to. There were the issues, of course, with doctors who sometimes pull you aside and say, look, you know, you better go easy on these things, your moral issues meaning, your stands, otherwise you're not really going to get on very well. I remember speaking as a young doctor, a visiting doctor from an African country, can't remember exactly what one, and he was a gynecologist in his country, and I don't know how it came up in conversation, became aware of my stance, and I think he actually was a Catholic, a sort of Catholic, and he basically said, with your views like that, I wouldn't pass you in the medical school. I wouldn't pass you in my medical school. He was quite adamant. I think he was a gynecologist of some sort. So that was quite challenging. Of course, when patients take great offence to your stance, that can be quite challenging and difficult, quite nerve-wracking sometimes. But I think the most critical event that happened to me was when I was actually sued by a young woman for what we call wrongful birth. She was a girl that I saw, and I refused to give the morning after pill to. And somehow or other, she got maybe contact with the parents and then legal side, and they sued for wrongful birth because she actually had the child. And I had to, of course, report it to my medical defence. And I was quite disheartened, really, because we had a good case. We had a very good case. In fact, the boyfriend who was actually in jail at the time of this case wanted to contact me. And he actually said he and his girlfriend went round to see his mother, and the mother said, well, look, yeah, that Dr. Fung doesn't prescribe the pill. Why don't you go and see somebody else? And she refused. So it was all a bit of a ruse anyway to get money. So we had a good case because she actually refused to see another doctor anyway. Not that I would have advised that. So they just basically used this as an occasion to get some money out of the system. So I was quite disappointed with the insurance company who didn't want to run a case, and they just settled out of court, you know. So that was very disheartening, and I think being sued is not a pleasant, and that was a bit of a critical stage where I felt, well, why bother? Why go on with this when this is what you get back in your face? But I think your prayer life, your faith keeps you going. You know, God really wants you. Sometimes you know you're in the right place when you don't feel like you're in the right place, but you know you should be there. That's just part of the Christian struggle, much like our Lord. You know, you're following the cross. You have to take the cross and the insults. And then good comes. Our Lord always draws good out of difficult circumstances and so on. It makes you a bit tougher and so on. So yeah, I think that was quite a big issue, because I really felt like giving it away after that episode. I really did. I think, well, why bother? You know, I'll do something else which would be easier. But you know, the Lord pushes you back and says, no, you know, and here I am still practicing after that. That was a while ago now. It must be at least 10 years ago now, so we've certainly moved on from that. But yeah, there's some of the challenges that have happened during my life and career.
I guess just talking about the case of the wrongful birth, what do you see going into the future as the role of the GP or anyone involved in medicine? What do you see as the role being, as there seems to be a shift from what you were referring to as the healing vocation to kind of simply a dispenser of medical goods? Do you mind giving your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, that's a difficult question, but a very good question. There is a great deal of influence and unfortunate interference in the role of the healing arts and the role of medicine. And like many things, there is a tendency for bureaucratic control, and it does really impinge on your work, on your life as a doctor. The so-called bureaucratic red tape. There is a lot of pressure, because I think there's good pressure and there's bad pressure. Pope John Paul II, when he was a patient in the Gemelli Clinic, he used to call his doctors the Sanhedrin, quite a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, and he was using that as an example to say, look, as a patient, I have the right to be fully involved in the decision-making process. And I think that's quite right. I think that's important. That human person, just because he or she is a patient, doesn't lose their dignity. And in fact, I think people are becoming more aware of their rights as a patient, which is good. I think a lot of the treatments that sometimes we give, especially to patients with cancer with no hope of cure, are wrong. We should stop. We should call a halt and say, no, this is just useless treatment. It's not justifiable. It's just trying to put people in statistics and, you know, do the numbers to see what could help. It's experimenting on people. I think there's sometimes a time to pull out and say, let's just make you comfortable, take away the pain, and let you, you know, prepare yourself for that final journey, you know, beyond death. So I think the point I'm trying to emphasise is, yes, there's a good point to, when you say dispense of goods, where people become more of their rights as a patient to be able to pick and choose between treatments and be treated with respect. I think that's good. But the flip side to that is the demand, I want you to do what I want you to do. I want IVF, I want the pill, I want contraception, I want an abortion. That's where it goes too far, because then they're impinging upon the rights of other people, like the unborn, and then they're contradicting their own self-dignity as a human person. For instance, contraception, it's very hard, of course, for people to understand this given our culture and time, but to use contraception at its deepest level is to manipulate your body and to not give yourself totally as a total gift to the other person. Now, these are very, obviously, deep philosophical concepts that often people struggle I don't blame them for not really grasping this, but I think people understand generally the notion of use. When you feel used, nobody likes to feel used. Yet, in our society, the way we're acting towards each other, we're beginning to do it more and more and more for many reasons. Use people for pleasure, use people for money. But that's contrary to the dignity of the human person. So that's what's involved in some of these issues that people don't think through it, that they're actually using somebody. One of the worst cases was when a woman I remember, she would talk to me, she said she planned to break up with her boyfriend. There's no doubt in mind. But she still wanted to continue to have intimate sexual relationships with him until then. And I thought to myself, that is just crazy. Here you are giving yourself to your boyfriend. You know, okay, it's not a marriage situation, but you know what I mean? And you're just using him for sex until you can break up with him. I was just staggered by that particular attitude. But this is permeating more and more in our society. But I think sometimes as a doctor you have to say, you know, no, well, I can't go along with that. So that's the flip side. The good side is people are aware of their dignity and their rights. to be involved in the decision-making process. So you, in a sense, you put out the choices and then they make the choice. But I have to draw a line where those choices impinge on human dignity, their own personal dignity, or they contradict the dignity of somebody else, like abortion, the killing a human being. So, yeah, it's this is a real challenge. And I think we have to find our way very carefully in this area. Doctors just not simply there to write whatever or do whatever the patient wants, more to be an advocate, but also to be an advocate in the widest sense for human dignity as well. Yeah.
So do you have any advice out there to close for medical students and especially for Catholic medical students?
Any advice for Catholic medical students? Look, I think obviously you've got to be the best doctor you can to learn your craft, to pass your exams, to get that medical knowledge. Secondly, I think learn to think outside the square, because there's a lot of stuff that's happening in the medical world that's put forward as evidence-based medicine, we call it. And yet if you scratch beneath the surface, there's a lot of issues, there's a lot of problems with it. Now, I'll take the case in point, which one of my colleagues, Dr. Deirdre Little, is particularly good at, the Bellingen GP, very wonderful woman, and she's pointing out the danger of Gardasil, which is the vaccine to prevent human papillomavirus infection. Really, if you're not sexually active, if you're abstinent till you're married, you won't have any problems with getting this particular infection, which can lead to an increased risk of cervical cancer. But she's found that by studying the data that fertility has dropped with the introduction of Gardasil. And there's just been this almighty rush to get this done, to get it approved and then get it foisted on young girls and now boys, young men, without the proper research. Yet it's supposed to be evidence-based. In other words, if you scratch beneath the surface, you can actually find there are actually cover-ups, medical scandals that are waiting to break. But the problem is there is corruption that's very difficult to fight. Now, this is going to be a difficult thing. Once you start to stretch beneath the surface, you'll find there are problems. You know, the classic example, another classic example is the oral contraceptive pill. Now, more than 1 million women in Australia take the pill. Amazing, isn't it? But the pill increases your risk of getting breast cancer, something like 25% if you haven't had a child, if you start taking, which is probably at least 50% of women in that position, increases your risk of breast cancer at least 25%. And that's just huge. The infertility it causes, cervical cancer risk. You know, there's a whole lot of death, the risk of death. You know, there's six women out of a million, something of the order of six per million women on the pill will die from a blood clot on the pill. You know, who tells you all this stuff? You know, there's money involved. Then the whole issue of what we call xenoestrogens and the effect on fertility. You know, male fertility has dropped 40%, the World Health Organization has told us. And it's not genetic, we're told. It's got to be environmental. Well, what are the environmental causes? You know, xenoestrogens, biologically active chemicals that act like estrogens in our bodies, are affecting our health. They're in pesticides, plastics. You know, you're not allowed to have BPA now, bisphenol A in baby sippy cups, which is a cofactor in the formation of the plastic because of its toxic effects. And yet, BPA is found in the lining of canned food. How about that? They did a study that I think they didn't drink this soup every day for a week. I think it was even less than a week, if my memory serves me correct. They compared it with people who drank normal soup to those who were drinking canned soup. And they found the BPA levels, bisphenol A levels, were 12 times, 1,200% more than those who had normal soup. It's toxic, you see. So this is another area which I'd really like the students to be aware of. You know, think outside the square. Don't accept everything you're told in medical school as gospel. because you're going to uncover things that are not going to be very pleasant. The immunizations that have come from fetal lines from aborted cell tissues, you know, this is a big problem. I haven't got an answer for it, but it's there. There's some papal documents on this stuff. So that would be another thing. You think outside the screen. Thirdly, and perhaps especially the most important, is you might need a very strong faith. You need a very strong faith life. You need a very strong prayer life, because they're not just these moral issues to deal with. They're just the normal, mundane, ordinary issues, if you like. Greed. As a GP, as a doctor, you have the potential to make a lot of money. What are you going to do with that money? You can't take it with you. You know, we've got to use that spare money that we have. I'm not saying that we can't have a good and lifestyle, which is necessary, of course, with our station in life. But, you know, are we coming to help the poor? Are we going to help the work of the church? Because greed is certainly a great temptation. It's something I have to struggle with all the time. And, you know, the other seven deadly sins, you know, you, as a doctor, you're more exposed to than temptation than others. So we obviously need a very strong spiritual and prayer life, strong motivations to do these things for God's greater glory, and not for selfish reasons to enter the role, because it's a very noble and healing art. And just yesterday, because I've had a few patients who've committed suicide, or I've known of people committing suicide very recently, I think this is so important to be aware of that. And I was just speaking to a patient whom I've seen grow up as a young girl. Now she's 20, and she said she couldn't sleep. And I said, "Oh, I've scratched a bit because I know the family well." And she's suffering from depression. And I said, "Have you ever thought of harming yourself?" And she said, "Yes, I have. In fact, you know," and she's in good friends with a girl who actually tried to kill herself, and she's visiting in the hospital, but she's got depression. So a lot of youth suicide, teenage suicide going, because there's a lot of depression. And I really, getting back to Pope John Paul II, Theology of the Body, I really think we need to have a bit of that behind us, because a lot of people are not Christians. A lot of people don't have meaning in their lives. A lot of people need to hear the message of Theology of the Body, that, you know, the meaning of life is found in giving and receiving love. And if we don't have this love in our lives, we don't understand ourselves. Or to quote Pope John Paul II, life is meaningless unless we encounter love. If we do not experience it and make it our own, and if we do not participate intimately in it. You know, that was one of his great statements. You may have even mentioned that, I think, in his first encyclical, Redemptor Hominis. So, and the church always says, to keep up your religious knowledge, you know, the development, not just, you've got to move on from the catechism, you've got to build that knowledge, of course, read the big Catholic catechism, but you need to build your knowledge so that your knowledge base in your faith is equal to, if not more, than the medical knowledge you have, so you can bring these things into your consultation. You can, you know, share people, support them, and give them reasons for hope, because I see a lot of lack of hope, especially in young people, and sometimes older. I've just had a patient who killed herself just a couple of weeks ago, and I had no idea I knew she had suffered from depression, but I had no idea it got that bad, and she leaves two young teenage children and a husband, you know. So, yeah, we need that philosophical basis to reach out to people, you know, the Theology of the Body, to give people reasons for living, reasons for hope, you know, meaning in life. And it doesn't necessarily have to be framed in explicitly religious dimensions, although when it's opportune, and it should be done, I think, you know, to give resources, religious resources. People need to turn to prayer. I think they should be told. We shouldn't be afraid to bring in a religious dimension into practice as a doctor. But, yeah, all of those things, you know, be the best doctor you can, think outside the square, a deeper prayer life, and deepen your knowledge of the faith to be commensurate with your medical knowledge. I think those are the four things I'd really like to impress if I'd had some advice to give to medical students.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Andrew Fung, for your words. And I really pray for your efforts as a medical practitioner, especially for your evangelization through your vocation in a healing ministry. So thank you very much.
You're welcome, Luke. Thank you for asking me.
That was an interview with Dr. Andrew Fung. And for more interviews, visit cradio.org.au.